For the week of March 20th, 2016, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 316, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Shanghai, I'm Michael Giltz.
You're in Shanghai?
Well, we just decided, you know, we might as well just open up an office in China, right? All the news is in China.
Oh,
I
see.
Our box office is in China. Our industry news is in China. Everything's affected by China. So we finally decided, I'm here in Shanghai just on a business trip, and I'm going to be based in Guangzhou at the White Swan. Come by and say hi if you're one of our Chinese listeners. Sperling, didn't you get the memo that I was moving?
No, I did not get the memo that you were moving. I did get our show notes, which are basically, they're not in Chinese, but when I looked at them, I had to do a double take because I was wondering if I was reading last week's notes.
There are not that many stories about China this week, but tell us what we'll be covering.
Well, on this week's show, we'll discuss, believe it or not, China, as you just mentioned. The government is cracking down on anyone fudging box office numbers, and they mean you, Ip Man. But the real controversy this week is over The Screening Room, a company that wants to make big blockbuster movies available in your home the same day they open in movie theaters.
What a great idea.
Yeah, good luck. Everyone, and we do mean everyone, is weighing in from the indie exhibitors to the National Association of Theater Owners to European distributors and exhibitors to seemingly every major director in Hollywood. Those who think The Screening Room is a good idea all have one thing in common, and we'll tell you what that is. During Inside Baseball, we'll look at radio. CBS is looking to offload its fabled radio group, so someone call Warren Buffett. It's a good, stable, long-term business, but it doesn't have sexy growth potential, so CBS apparently wants out. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines, but first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
People do know you're joking when we say that, right? But anyway, we look at box office from around the world, of course, not just North America. We get our information from RenTrak. We have our links in the show notes. We also pull info from Box Office Profits, Box Office Mojo, LA Times, New York Times, Hollywood Reporter, Variety, you name it. Anywhere we can track down information on worldwide grosses and the number one movie around the world. People love animals, especially when they're animated. It's Disney's Zootopia. Another $100 million over the weekend, and it's just about to hit $600 million worldwide. This is a big hit.
Have you seen the movie yet?
I have not.
You know, I was going to see it this week. Instead, I went to see Bruce Springsteen.
Oh!
Yes. I guess he's performing a show where he does, and I know this has nothing to do with box office, by the way.
Nothing. He does The River in entirety. Was it a good show?
Yeah, I had no idea he was doing The River in its entirety. As you know, Michael, I'm a big Bruce Springsteen fan. And so I went and I thought, well, this will be fun. You know, first of all, I lowered the average age in the arena by probably 15 years. Okay.
Oh, I don't know about that.
This guy, I swear, I was exhausted just watching him. I mean, he sings in its entirety, first song, second song, he tracks the entire River album. It's a double album. It's like 20 songs. And then he performs it entirely, like for an hour and a half longer. It was unbelievable.
Cool. Where were your seats?
I did get a nosebleed while going to them. But they were right off to the side of the stage, and they were in the sports arena here in Los Angeles, which is being torn down.
Rightly or wrongly?
Well, the acoustics in that place are horrible, and nobody's using it anymore, even for sports, so it really does need...
Rightly. So, yeah. Bruce Springsteen is a hit on the tour. He has a memoir coming out, I think, in October, or later this year, maybe September or October, and Zootopia is a hit at the box office. Look at it compared to Kung Fu Panda 3. Kung Fu Panda 3 is at number 4 on our worldwide box office chart. It grossed $32 million over the weekend, and it's about to hit $400 million worldwide. And if you told me 2 months ago, you know, as always, you never know anything until the movies actually come out and people see them. Kung Fu Panda 3 got great reviews, known franchise, you know, all these things to make it work in China and overseas. And I expected it to do great stuff. Zootopia was a roll of the dice. Nobody had seen it. They weren't sure. Look who wins. They're both winners, ultimately, based on their budgets. But Zootopia is really tearing it up. About a week ago, Kung Fu Panda 3 set the all-time record for an animated film in China. Now that's been passed by Zootopia. That didn't take long. It's making 50% more money right now and still tearing it up. They both have a ways to go. Kung Fu Panda 3 has a number of territories left in its, you know, in its quiver, if you like. And so we'll see where it ends up, but it's profitable. Zootopia is profitable. Everybody's happy. And number two around the world is a movie that makes nobody happy. It's the Divergent series, and it's the movie called Allegiant. It's from Lionsgate. It grossed $50 million over the weekend. It's at $82 million worldwide. Everybody's angry about it. Everybody.
Well, because it's bad?
It is terrible. The first movie got okay reviews. The second movie got much worse reviews. And the third movie got much worse reviews than the second one. That's certainly not a good thing. People are also angry that they split the final book in the trilogy into two movies, just like, you know, The Hunger Games and Twilight and The Last Harry Potter. People are very angry about that. And you have to question the judgment of doing that when your movies are getting worse and worse reviews, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, we talked about that from the very beginning, whether it was a good idea to split that book in two.
Yeah, you know, it's always a not a good idea artistically, unless the book is 1,000 pages long or whatever. But so, yeah, so people are yelling and screaming what a horrible idea it is. And they're comparing, like, opening weekend box office. The second movie made 40% less than the first movie in North America. And then the third movie made 40%. It's like, well, ignore all that. Just look at what the movies cost and what they made. The first movie made $275 million worldwide on an $85 million budget. When? The second movie made just under $300 million. So just about $20 million more, right? $20 million more, made $295 million worldwide on a $110 million budget. Well, they spent $25 million more on the budget and only made an extra $20 million at the box office. That should have set off alarm bells, right? You're like, wait a second, maybe better rethink this, you know, third book turned into two movies.
Right? Well, but I think everybody said, we said that at the time, remember?
Yeah, it's like, yeah, you know, look, you got really bad reviews. They made less money in North America. They made it up overseas, but not dramatically so. They should have been thrilled that they hadn't lost their shirt. You know, they paid all that money and they barely made back the extra money they spent on their budget, but still, $110 million budget, $300 million worldwide box office. They're going to be fine financially. And if they just made one more movie, they probably could have expected to make another $300 million worldwide at the box office. Instead, they've got two movies coming. The reviews are poisonous. We'll have to see where the movie ends up. It's clearly going to make even less than the second in North America. Will they be able to make it up overseas? Maybe, but it's certainly a roll of the dice they didn't need to take.
Now, speaking of rolls of the dice, I mean, The Revenant. Okay, remember this film? They shot in Canada. They shot in Argentina. They had to chase the snow. It was supposed to cost $90 million. It cost $140 to shoot. Well, in the end, not such a bad move.
Not when you've got Leonardo DiCaprio as your star. Another $37 million over the weekend. It's at $483 million worldwide. All that money this weekend came from China.
Yeah, it's still in 25 territories, but nearly $500 million. Inuyuritu, the director, must be very happy.
So is J.J. Abrams, did he do Cloverfield?
Well, I don't think he directed it.
No, he didn't do it, but that's the thing he sort of launched. Yes. He's got to be happy with the makings of 10 Cloverfield Lane. This is a spinoff, spiritual successor, call it whatever you want, to the Godzilla-like monster movie Cloverfield. That was a found footage movie. This movie is completely different in concept. In fact, they sort of linked it up at the last minute to the Cloverfield idea. It was its own standalone screenplay that they got the idea to link them up. It cost $15 million to make. Guess what? It made $17 million this weekend alone. It's at $52 million worldwide. So another win for everybody, plus great reviews. That doesn't happen a lot with this sort of low-budget, sci-fi horror-type movie.
Yeah, they're almost throwaways.
Yes, and number six is London Has Fallen. Another $16 million over the weekend. It's just about to hit $100 million worldwide. We got a faith-based movie at number seven, Miracles from Heaven. I guess anyone who didn't watch, what was it called? The Passion?
The Passion, and then there was, there's a whole bunch of them.
Last night on live Fox television.
Oh, I didn't watch it.
The Easter special they had on Fox. Well, no wonder it didn't do it. It did okay, but it didn't do great, and you're the reason. This was an Easter-type special. It's aired on Fox Live last night. They did it down in New Orleans. We talked about it before. Netflix just picked up the worldwide streaming rights, so if you're not in North America, well, I guess they'll show it on Netflix here in the U.S. too. So pretty soon Netflix will have it to rebroadcast as we lead up to Easter, which I think was a smart deal. You got this timely holiday special, let Netflix show it all over the world very quickly, you know, after you've had your big huzzah on network TV. So we'll have to see how that works out. But if you weren't watching that movie on TV, that special, you were going to see Miracles from Heaven, a faith-based movie about a little girl who's very sick, but then she makes a trip to heaven and she gets better. Made $15 million over the weekend. It opened on Wednesday, I think, so it's made $18 million worldwide. Basically, it's only open here in the U.S., and it only costs $13 million to make, so everybody's happy.
Yeah, there was an article in The Hollywood Reporter that was the takeaway from it was that, hey, you know, faith-based movies, they used to be poison for an actor's career, but not so anymore. Now you have, you know, Greg Kinnear and some big-name actors, Ewan McGregor, starring in these things, and it's not harming their careers.
Well, I think you've got it the other way around, and I think they did too. Making crappy little movies is bad and poisonous for your career because that means you're making something going straight to DVD or VHS or something that's being, you know, faith-based movies were typically being made by like parishes or little churches and they would crowdfund the movie. So they were crappy little movies that might have appealed to some people, but they weren't artistically good. And if you're making that, you might as well be in Italy making some crappy horror film. You know, it's just a sign that you've reached the end of your sell-by date. It's not a sign that the movies are going to be poisonous for you if you make a movie that has to do with religion. It's a sign that if you're making crappy, low-budget, nothing movies that are never going to be seen by most people, your career's sort of in a tailspin.
Well, and so, before yes, everybody from it.
The budgets have bumped up. It's $13 million. You've got some talented actors on it. That means the movie won't suck necessarily. So therefore, it's a respectable movie where you're getting a respectable salary, not a desperate bid to keep your career alive.
And before everybody from Italy writes in and tells us that you make more.
Dario Argento or something like that. A great, great director.
Yeah. Just, you know, I'm sure Michael just picked a country out of a hat and.
Well, there were a string of really low-budget, bad horror movies. Every country has their B and C movies. I love Italy, and that just happened to be the one that sprang to mind. And number eight is Deadpool. Ryan Reynolds, my God, is he the biggest star in the world at the moment? It made $14 million over the weekend. It's at $730 million worldwide. I got dizzy trying to figure out how well it had done compared to Marvel movies and superhero movies in general. It's just way up the charts as far as debut movies for a superhero. It's tremendously successful. And one way to tell is to look at the list of upcoming Marvel movies. There are 10 of them.
Oh, my God. You know, and I was reading this story with Zack Snyder. It was an interview with Zack Snyder.
You were reading a story with Zack Snyder? Was he sitting on your lap?
Well, no. It was an interview with him and his wife, who is his producing partner. And they're talking about the Justice League and Batman versus Superman and all of the DC comic adaptations that he is directing and or producing. And I just thought, okay, there's like 9 films listed here. How about you just like work on one of them and make sure one of them is good?
But that's not how the world works, right? It's like saying you should just work on one show. Well, that's a bad comparison because I think you should do that if you're lucky enough to get a show on a network. But yeah, when you're a studio and you're overseeing a bunch of movies for the next, you got to map out your strategy for 5 years, 10 years. You don't just make one movie at a time, right? It's not a bespoke. You gotta have the treadmill going. It's not how it worked in the classic Hollywood days. It's not how it works today, right?
Well, in the classic Hollywood days, you know, movies were the biggest thing going. You didn't have TV, right? Or you had TV, but it was emerging. So, you know.
No, there was really no TV in the 30s and 40s. I mean, it existed, but yeah, there was no TV.
Yeah, and they churned out movies.
It was radio.
Yeah.
So, right, but I'm just saying, you know, Hollywood doesn't work on a one movie at a time world. You're a studio head or you're overseeing the DC properties. You have to plan out what you want to do, you know, 10 years down the road. I agree. We're in an era, it's like the Western, if you're going to talk about TV. It used to be a period when there were literally like 8 of the top 10 shows, 15 of the top 20 were all Westerns. It's all you saw on network television. Every night of the week was a damn Western. And I'm sure they thought that era would never end. And now you rarely see Westerns. You know, it's
well,
an event.
And I'm not talking about like, you know, superhero movies in general. If you're the head of a studio, sure, plan out your slate. You have to do that. But if you're actually manufacturing the product, why not like focus on manufacturing that particular product that you happen to be manufacturing at that moment and let the studio head worry about the slate?
So you want him to turn down the opportunity to oversee the DC properties and make tens of millions of dollars, or if not hundreds of millions of dollars?
You know, when you put it that way, it does not make me sound very smart.
I do think that, you know, there's going to be a glut of superhero movies and people are going to eventually tire of it. But, you know, that era of Westerns lasted
eventually,
for decades.
Eventually?
If that era of Westerns lasted for decades, there's no reason why you can't make good superhero movies. And it's just the thing that we watch. At number 9 is the thing we didn't watch, Gods of Egypt. Is this Lionsgate as well?
Yes, it is.
Poor guys. $7 million over the weekend, $130 million worldwide. And number 10 is a Bollywood movie. It's Kapoor and Sons since 1921. Good for them. It made $6.8 million on its opening weekend. I couldn't figure out the budget, but it's probably not huge. It's a family drama with humorous elements. It can't be that big a budget. It's certainly a high quality Bollywood movie, but it's had a solid opening weekend as far as I can tell. And, you know, again, this movie opened in North America, which is interesting to me. Kapoor and Sons opened on 143 screens in North America. It's on a screen in Birmingham, Alabama. There must be some Indian community in Birmingham, Alabama that I'm not aware of, because they consistently have, it's a multiplex, right? There's more than one theater in Birmingham, Alabama, but the one I go to is the Summit. It's like a 16 screen multiplex. So they've got a screen. Why wouldn't they show it for a week? You know, they can get people in there, but that's the worldwide cinema we live in now. But it's very cool to me that Bollywood movies and more Asian films and more films from, you know, Korea and China are getting seen in theaters in North America.
And when they do show them in North America, what's remarkable is that the box office that is reported for them, in this case, it's $965,000 for Kapoor and Sons here in the United States and Canada. I can almost guarantee that they rarely, if ever, have to then go back and revise the numbers that they
get. So we're talking about Ip Man 3, which is the latest in a Chinese martial arts series or franchise. And they got in trouble, didn't they? But why? That's what I want. I'm asking you a question you can't answer. It's not fair. But the Chinese government cracked down on the distributor because they decided they inflated the opening weekend box office by about $5 million. And they said, And they've given them a penalty, haven't they?
Yeah, they said you cannot release movies. I think it's for 1 month.
For 1 month. Did they have any movies scheduled for a month? Can they release the movie they were going to put out that month next month? It sounds like a pretty bizarre, lame penalty, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's... It really is. I don't know where the punishment comes from.
Are they making a symbolic statement here? Look, we don't want this. Are they pretending to take action without actually doing anything significant? A lot of questions here, as far as I'm concerned. But at least they did acknowledge, hey, this movie's, you know, box office was inflated. They had fake screenings, fake ticket sales. Three online ticketing services and 73 cinemas were also admonished. Are we going to go to that silly, oh, they've lost face and that means a lot in Asia. Therefore, this is going to, you know, the actual practical effect is that they did virtually nothing as far as I can tell, but they did acknowledge it and make a fuss about it. So maybe that's a good step forward.
What was the film where apparently the film was playing to empty houses, but then when you check the...
That was a
government... Monster Hunt or something like that? Or, no. Yeah,
well, no. Well, Monster Hunt was a big hit, but there was a political movie that was a government sort of funded, you know, propaganda, and people were wanting to see some other movie. And so they would just write the name of the movie they were actually seeing on the ticket. But in fact, they paid for a movie to the political film. I know that happened. I'm not sure about
Monster. Yeah, we reported on it at the time.
Yes. So that all those are the shenanigans that go on to inflate the box office. Nobody inflated the box office of The Bronze, though. Before we leave box office, I should mention this movie. Did you see this at Sundance? This was a Sundance favorite about a foul-mouthed Olympian.
Well, favorite. I don't know about favorite.
It got picked up.
It got trapped into
a nightmare of relativity. That's better than most movies at Sundance, right? Most movies don't get picked up.
Yes, and I can tell you that I did see this movie at Sundance in 2015. It opened
was it
Sundance,
good?
And it was one of those movies that should have been a Saturday Night Live skit. It was very uneven. It had some wonderful direction in it in moments, and the main character, who is a girl who is
a woman
now. Yeah, she played a character who was a former gymnastics Olympian who never really kind of amounted to anything. It was funny, but yeah, no.
Right. So it opened in North America, it escaped the relativity nightmare, got picked up by Sony Pictures Classics, God knows why, a rare misstep for them, in the sense of picking a bad movie and releasing. You know, usually they have good taste. Even if the movie doesn't click, they get every penny out of it that they could. Here, somehow, they picked up this movie, did a wide release, which is very much against the Sony Picture Classics modus operandi. 1,100 screens it opened on, and it grossed $361 per screen. That has to be one of the lowest opening weekends for a wide release ever.
Well, but its total gross to date is $8.7 million. How is that? Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm looking at a completely different movie called Lady in the Van. Yes.
No, no. The total gross is like $300,000.
Yeah, $421,000. Yeah, it's, I mean, this is a movie that you watched it and you kind of went, wow, that's going to go straight to DVD.
And even the title is wrong because the joke should be the silver. Because bronze, actually, the thing is that for Olympians, you get to be an Olympian. That's amazing already. Someone says, oh, I was an Olympian. You should just say, wow, that's awesome. Congratulations. What event? What was the experience like? You should not say, what was your medal? Did you get a gold? You know, that's like, I was an Olympian, damn it. That's an accomplishment, right? But if you do get the Olympics and you do medal, of course you want gold.
Right.
And if you don't get gold, if you get bronze, you can say, hey, at least I medaled. But when you get silver, it's like, you did get gold.
Yeah,
exactly. So silver is a lot funnier than bronze, but they didn't even know that.
Yeah, it was, you know, Melissa Rauch, I think, was the played the girl. It was one of those movies that by the end of Sundance, you're like, oh, yeah, that's right. The bronze opened.
Is she supposed to be 16 or 17?
No, I think she's supposed to be like, more like 20, 21, 22. You know?
Well, then don't call her a girl.
Okay, fine.
Hillary Clinton's about to be your president, so you need to learn this stuff now.
Well, how do
you want to learn about the screening room.
We talked about this last week, if you recall.
I know, but it's too much fun.
Yes, and I thought at the time, well, it's a shame I didn't do all of my interviews on this, on the screening room. We spoke on Monday, right? We talked about it on Monday, and then the rest of the day was spent interviewing people about the screening room, but all industry insiders. And I thought, oh, it's a shame I couldn't do that a day before you and I spoke on Showbiz Sandbox. Well, who knew that this story would have 2 weeks of legs?
More than that, obviously, because it has to fall apart at some point. And I think we can already say safely that it will, since the vast majority of people seem to be against it. Here's my first question. Everyone who thinks the screening room is a good idea has one thing in common. What is it?
Well, they were all given stock by the company. So, and for no, you know, they're not paid, but Peter Jackson, J.J. Abrams, Steven Spielberg, they were all given, like, you're an advisor, you're on the board of advisors, or you're one of our, you know, consultants, and oh, by the way, here's some stock. But can you talk to Variety and The Hollywood Reporter and say what a great idea this is?
But they've done it on their own, and nobody seems to be reporting that. I mean, I've seen the Variety and Hollywood Reporter stories where they quote Peter Jackson and they quote J.J. Abrams, and they don't say, by the way, they were given a stake in the company, nor do they say, how much of a stake were you given? How big is that stake? How do you tend to profit from it? Have you invested any money? Why are they not doing that? It's like journalism 101.
Yeah, I was a little shocked myself toward
like
the
you
end.
You can't report that Peter Jackson thinks it's a great idea and not acknowledge that he's been given a piece of the company.
Well, that's
ridiculous.
That and Peter Jackson and the J.J. Abrams story in The Hollywood Reporter, neither of them mentioned it that I can recall. And that's what kind of made me go,
no, they didn't mention when they list the people who are on the board. They don't say, by the way, they were given a piece of the company when to be on the board. Nor did somebody invested money. We don't know how much. Most of them did not and were given a piece. One of them or more may have invested some money. We don't know how much it was or how much of a stake they got. We don't know anything because nobody seems to be asking them, and they won't come on our show because they know we'll hold them to the fire. But anyway,
well,
I think
you
that's
know what we haven't done? You know who doesn't know anything? Our listeners. They have no idea what the screening room is. We should probably tell you what it is. Right. It is a service where you pay $150 for a set-top box.
You get access to. You're renting it, basically.
Yes. And then you get to buy movies that are going to open in theaters. So let's say Deadpool, for instance.
Or Batman versus Superman. Let's look to the future.
Okay. Well, you'd pay $50 and you would get 48 hours to watch that film on your television at home for $50. That's the plan.
Right. It's a day and date movie watching. And as we know, day and date happens all the time, all over the industry.
However,
it happens all over the world.
However,
but not for big budget Hollywood movies.
However, I will point this out. In all of my discussions last week, what I was told time and again, if you look at roadside attractions, if you look at Amazon,
IFC,
more and more, these companies are moving away from doing day and date releases, even for independent films. Okay, yeah. So it used to be that a smaller independent film that was going to open on 40, 50, 60, 100 screens would open day and date.
40, 50, that's a lot. 100 screens is a lot.
Well,
I was thinking more like the movies that open on a couple screens and that's it.
Well, I, you know, and I'm doing.
I'm wondering if that changed.
Margin
as well.
Call arbitrage, these types of deals. And why is that, Michael? I can tell you why that is based on my conversations last week. I thought of you every single time it was said the phrase, these distributors feel they are leaving money on the table by skipping the theatrical window. I thought, wow, we've come full circle. It was, you know, hey, the window is too short or too long. Now it's too short, and we're all going back to this exclusive.
So even
window
IFC,
for
when they've got their movies, they're not making them, because you would see stuff pop up on video on demand even before it hit theaters.
Yeah,
and you know, for a lot of the country, it's never going to play there. And so the idea was, well, you're going to advertise it, you're going to do whatever, and so it would be in New York and LA and some other, maybe Chicago and some other cities, but then you'd have it on video on demand for the people in 90% of the country where there was no movie theater within an hour's drive that they could go to see the movie. And that's not happening as much?
That is not happening as much. There are distributors that will still do it, although...
But it's out of favor.
It's out of favor, correct. Now, what is still in favor is the early electronic sell-through, and what I mean by that is... You know, when Deadpool is gets put on iTunes.
That's another window. Let's not confuse things.
That's not
confusing.
Completely
that's a
different window.
Yeah, no, that's a totally different issue. So the idea is big Hollywood movies, not just documentaries and a little art house fare, but big Hollywood movies would be available in your home. You just pay $50. You can invite over your friends, or you don't have to get a babysitter, and everybody's happy, right? That's the idea that these guys are trying to pitch to everybody. And they've sort of got AMC on board. But this was the fun thing. I think we mentioned it last week. AMC was on board and signed a letter of intent if they meet all sort of requirements. So it's a far from a done deal. But they were on board at the behest of Wanda. That was how it was termed in Variety of the Hollywood Reporter. It was one line saying that they had signed on to this, or they had agreed and to move forward, but only at the behest of Wanda.
Which kind of tells you where the money's coming from.
Well, Wanda owns AMC. But you're thinking, A, they didn't want to do it. So that's an interesting, because they're making clear, by the way, this wasn't our doing. It was our bosses over in China, meaning Wanda, meaning, they don't like the idea. So even the American people at AMC probably are not down into it, but they were pressured to do it by their bosses, which, of course, is their right. So I wonder why Wanda would think it's a good idea.
I don't know why. What the immediate reaction would be, there must be some investment or some money from China flowing through into the screening room. I can't say.
Well, but I mean, they're undercutting their investment in money that they've invested in film exhibition all over the world.
Yeah, I don't know why they would force that.
So that's interesting. So we got basically this week more people weighed in. Indie film exhibitors weighed in, NATO weighed in, European exhibitors weighed in, and top directors weighed in. Now, what do the indie film exhibitors say?
What do they all have in common? They all hate it. That's the one thing. Well, the Art House Convergence is about 600 independent film exhibitors all over the country.
Sounds like a flash mob. Art House Convergence.
Well, it was a trade show right before Sundance every year, so that's where that name comes from. They support, indeed, play films day and date, as we just talked about.
I guess, than they used to.
Yes. But they have they're very concerned. They've got a lot of questions, and they do see encroachment on big studio movies as endangering the classic business model of going to the theater of movies. Mm-hmm. And that's really what I kept hearing about was, one, it's too cheap. If you're going to do this, start with the very basic pricing model. $50, let's face it. 5 years from now, you're going to want
to be... pricing is not the problem. It's the whole concept. It's not the fact that they don't have the right price level. They don't like the idea, period. So I don't want to get distracted by the price level.
No,
because we know that there are, as you mentioned last week, there's incredibly hot, upscale, super expensive for the 1% people do have access to movies. It costs like $35,000 to get a box, and you pay a ton of money to get your digital prints sent to you. So that happens. It's a business. But as far as the mainstream America, whatever the price point is, they hate the idea.
Yeah. And, I'm only, again, pointing out what was said to me. So the price was one of the things that was mentioned. Also, and I received this on background, so I can't necessarily point to the person who said this or the group that said this. However, it was...
So this isn't necessarily an indie film exhibitor.
No. It was pointed out to me that in 2005, Robert Iger, the head of Disney, said hey, the theatrical window is too long. We need to shorten the theatrical window. And everybody was up in arms. How could you say that? You know, you're the head of Disney. And it was said again and again up until about 2010. He stopped saying that.
But the theatrical window has shortened.
Yes. Well, it's by about a month.
Now, well, that's a lot.
But what I will say is the one distributor that is not mentioned on this is Disney. And Disney has come out and said, no, we're not going to be participating.
We hate it.
Right. So it kind of speaks volumes when...
The studios were sort of like, I don't know. But Disney in particular was like, go away. That's a horrible idea.
Correct.
So they found religion.
Yes, they have. And that religion can be seen every weekend at the movie theater.
Right, where Zootopia is doing tremendous business. So one thing that everybody raises is piracy. Now, these people say, no, we've got it blocked up. We've got a great new system. It's going to be totally piracy, protected. It's not going to happen. I don't know why this would be their concern for piracy more than anything else. Aren't big movies pirated right now anyway? Aren't they all available, basically? I mean, I don't really check that stuff.
Yes, they are.
So, I mean, that doesn't seem a very valid concern.
It's a pretty specious. I don't even know if I'm using that word right, but
it's a straw man argument. It's like, of course, they fear a massive increase of piracy. It couldn't get any worse.
The argument of, this is for people who don't go to the movie theater anyway right now. It's increased revenue for the movie theaters.
Well, now you're going to an argument that the screening room is making. I was raising an argument that the art house people were raising. They said, what about piracy? To which I say, well, that's already a big problem. This doesn't seem to particularly increase or decrease that problem.
I would say it increases it tremendously because you can
how can it be more tremendous than available everywhere right now? You can go online and find Deadpool everywhere. So what's the problem?
The quality.
It's already a horrifically bad problem.
Well, and you're getting horrifically bad versions of
Deadpool. They all look spotless, I hear. I thought they were always like spotless. Nobody's sitting in a theater seat with a shaky hand cam anymore. They're getting digital prints or they're getting...
Oh, no. It's all cammed. But now you'll be
they're
able to...
They're still doing cams?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I thought that was dead.
No, far from it. And actually, what this will allow is you can aim your phone directly at a television screen and get a much clearer picture. Without having to worry about some usher coming by and arresting you or having you arrested.
So you're saying their concern about piracy is valid?
It's actually valid, yes.
All right, I'll be corrected. And of course, the next thing they say is, the screening room claims we're just going to target people who don't go to the movies regularly.
Right.
And to which we say, you and I don't know that they really raised this up. I was like, well, how do you do that?
well, and better yet, how do you know that? That was the question time and again that was asked of me. How do they know they aren't going to the movie theater?
Well, they say there must be an audience of people who like movies but don't go to the movies regularly. Right. So you somehow want to reach them. I'm not sure how you would do that as such. Why this, well, they say, well, they don't like going to the movies. Therefore, if you offer them a service in home, that will appeal to them.
Yeah, that was one of those arguments that every industry person I spoke with was like, yeah, you know what? No. Because really what you're doing is you're training them not to go to the movie theater. So, no.
Huh. And it will just appeal to people who already go to the movies.
Correct. You're basically saying, look, right now, you're interested in a product. You have to go somewhere to consume it, okay? So, you know what? We're going to make it easier for you not to have to go anywhere to consume it.
Now here was what I love. I figured out the indie exhibitors raised the question like, well, how are you going to split this money up, by the way? Like, give us some details. This is bizarre. How do you decide which theaters get which cut of which movie? You know, is it only the ones that are exhibiting them or is it, they had all sorts of questions that aren't explained. And so, they could say is, well, what's the deal? What exactly is this plan? And one thing that came out, and this is bizarre, this is their stupid ass plan. I'm sorry, but this is ridiculous, was that when you get your set-top box, you pay $150, you then are asked to designate your local cinema.
Because so you say, only ever
That's
go to
my
one.
Movie theater.
You only
That's,
ever go to one.
Right, because you only go to one, and the only one carries the one. You pick that movie theater, and then apparently... Anytime there's any cut of the revenue that goes to the theaters, that's your local theater, and that's the one that you quote unquote would have gone to, and so that's the one that gets your cut of whatever you pay.
Right.
That's insane. That is so stupid, wrong from how movies work that it's crazy.
Well, right now it all boils down to math, right, and a percentage of the take, And this is what was said to me time and again. Look at what you have here. You've got $50 coming in for a movie, okay? $10 is going to the screening room. $20 is going to the movie theater. $20 is going to the distributor.
Mm.
Why would they take only 40% from this home viewing option when they get 50% in the theater?
Right.
So they said, this is never going
to
fly.
Because you're reaching people who don't go to the movies. That's
yeah,
the idea.
That's not right. A valid
take a pay cut. It'll be great.
Exactly. It's not going
to
happen.
It's like CDs. Oh, you need a lower royalty rate. Trust us. It's a new technology. We're working it out. Give us 10%. You can have 40.
Right.
So NATO weighed in, of course. I liked their statement. They're like, basically, theatrical works. Don't be idiots. Windowing may need to be tweaked, as always, but we should be doing it with the distributors, meaning the studios, not some new company coming into town who doesn't know how we do business.
Well, and NATO wants to be seen as somebody who is willing to collaborate, right? So that's why they're saying that.
Well, for legal reasons, if nothing else.
Right. Well, and also they, you know, in 2011, remember what happened, right? You had the studios coming out saying, we're going to shorten the window and you know, here's the first title. And it was like it kind of caught NATO by storm and all the exhibitors were kind of flat-footed.
That was the Universal thing?
That was the Universal thing, the Eddie Murphy movie, right? Mm-hmm. Tower Heist, I think.
Yes.
And so now they're trying to say, look, don't just go off doing that kind of stuff. Work with us and we'll work with you. We're not completely irrational. So, and that's, they've maintained that ever since 2011. They've done a good job of spreading the word on that.
Of course, they got a little blindsided, but they had to react because all these big directors started weighing in. Mind you, not all of them were for it. James Cameron and Christopher Nolan apparently weren't given a stake in the screening room, or maybe they would have rejected it. Maybe they were offered it. I'd love to know that. And they said, this is a terrible idea. Both for artistic and business reasons, we think it's a ridiculous idea. Whereas Peter Jackson and J.J. Abrams said, this is great. This is so good. You're making the exhibitors part of the process. It respects everybody. It's different from the past. We love this idea. And so NATO had to weigh in. And I love what they said to the directors. They basically said, yeah, you guys are great. We love your movies. We don't tell you how to direct your movies, so maybe you should just let us decide what's best for our business.
Yeah, well, they're trying, you know, the screening room is taking a page out of Dolby's playbook. They're taking a page out of the playbook of, just anybody that wants to get anything pushed.
Get the creatives on board.
Exactly.
Except that there's nothing creative for them to get on board with. It's just money. There's no new technology. It's not like 3D or some new sound system or something that they can say, look at the creative possibilities of this. It's just, oh, hey, do it because, you know, we'll give you a piece of our company. There's absolutely no creative impulse behind this. No director would ever argue, no, I prefer people see movies in the home.
Well, really, Christopher Nolan would if, great, you know, Christopher what? Nolan would if you could build an IMAX screen in your living room and show 35 millimeter or 70 millimeter film.
I was a little surprised. Even the European exhibitors weighed in.
Oh, yeah. No, this is something that literally the reason we're talking about it for A, as long as
the entire world weighed in.
Yeah. And I kept thinking, wow, you know, if I came up with this idea, nobody would have said anything. They wouldn't have even have acknowledged it. But this guy, Sean Parker, doesn't because he's affiliated with Napster and Facebook and that's his history. All of a sudden, everybody's weighing in on this thing. They're all playing it seriously. They're taking it as if it's a.
Something. We were like, this isn't going to happen. That's what we said last week.
Yeah, I thought it was something that would kind of like rear its ugly head and be done with. And no, it's rearing its ugly head and then rearing it again and again and again.
Well, so only one week. This is not going to happen.
Yeah, when no, you have, I agree.
Yeah, this is not going to happen. The exhibitors just won't.
Yeah, I mean, so
but what the Europeans weighed in, what did they say? They said the same thing, right? They said they view it with concern. They say the model as outlined seems to offer little benefit to cinema operators. What? They get less revenue and their distribution partners while representing significant potential risks.
Yes, so, as in
like a good idea.
Training people not to go to the movie theater. Yeah, it's verdict is guilty.
Uh-uh.
Yeah,
we're going to gong it.
Yes. Well, yeah.
So is the weighing in of people was a big deal, but the proposal itself is a big whoop.
Oh, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, if relativity can make movies half as entertaining and unexpected with endings as happy as its own emergence from bankruptcy, they'll be just fine. The company has been tossing out plans and abandoning them almost daily. They were going to raise $100 million. I mean, make that $20 million. Make that nothing, in fact. But wait, maybe they've got $400 million on tap. Kevin Spacey would run the film and TV division. Kevin Spacey would not run the film and TV division. Nonetheless, a judge ruled that with the deals currently in place, and after some more hurdles are jumped over, Relativity would be ready to emerge from bankruptcy and start operating again. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal for Relativity, and I'm shocked. I thought with all the back and forth and BS in the last few weeks, there was no way the judge would say this was a good deal. I just can't believe it. I don't really know the numbers. I haven't been looking, but you know, the way they change their plans every other minute, you know, oh, we got all this money. Oh, we have no money. Oh, we got somebody else give us even more money. Kevin Spacey's going to be on board. He's going to be great. He's not actually. He's too busy. I just can't believe they thought this was a serious plan.
Well, there must be something in the plan that makes sense business-wise.
But since it changes every 5 minutes, that alone makes me think, I don't care how good the deal you've just put in front of me this minute is, 5 minutes ago and 10 minutes ago, you've changed your mind 17 different ways, and therefore I don't trust this plan.
That's why we're waiting 20 minutes before approving it.
Exactly.
Recently, we talked about a paperback reissue of Alex Haley's novel, Roots. It was tied into the new miniseries remake. The trade paperback for the 40-year-old release of Roots had a suggested price of $19, which puzzled, and as you can hear, annoyed Michael to no end. Now comes word that To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee is taking a similar tack. The late author's estate wasted no time in deciding to end forever the mass market edition of the classic novel, which has been a classroom staple for generations of students. This also annoyed Michael to no end. By some measure, only the plays Romeo and Juliet and Macbeth, both by Bill Shakespeare, I might add, are assigned more in middle and high school than To Kill a Mockingbird. So it's in third place. But the cheap $8 edition of To Kill a Mockingbird, which students could buy on discount for about $5, is no more. In its stead, a trade paperback edition that retails for $15. Big deal or big whoop?
Wow. It's an insane decision, I think. It's just crazy. Now the people who put out the trade paperback edition say, oh, we're going to offer a discount to students and schools and stuff, so it would end up being about $8. Great. That's still almost 50% more than they were paying, you know? And it just seems so penny-wise, pound-foolish. Oh, we'll charge more. And then guess what? Teachers will say, you know what? I'm going to get my kids that other book that only cost $5 or $6 rather than $8 or $9. This is a classic case of something that probably wouldn't have happened until Harper Lee was gone. It's an issue of copyright. The fact that people benefit for generations beyond an author's life rather than copyright, meaning that, you know, it should help you profit. It doesn't mean your grandchildren or massive multinational corporations should profit from something you created. It's just a bad idea every way you can think about it.
Well, I don't understand what, I mean, I guess we should kind of point out there's trade paperbacks.
But those are bigger sized and they're more expensive, and the whole industry has moved towards that. And there's mass market with the sort of smaller paperbacks that you'd see in an airport. You okay. Grab a copy.
And then there's, of course, hardcovers.
And e-books.
And e-books, right. So there's all these versions. Hey, kind of like Windows.
Absolutely. This is sort of like, I always compare it to the single in the music industry. From like the mid late 80s on, the record industry killed the single. You know, people grew up buying a 45, or they buy a cassette single, which they called a single, a CD single. It was a great way to like buy a song you love. You didn't think you'd love the album, but you wanted that song, or you're young, you don't have a lot of money. It was a great way to start collecting music. It was just a staple of the music industry for like 80 years. And then they killed it. And they said, no, we don't want you to buy singles. We want you to buy the whole damn album because we make more money that way. So they release a single and then yank it. And you couldn't buy it. So they try to force you to pay, you know, $15 for the album rather than $2 for that song that you liked, like Gangnam Style. You probably figure, I don't need that album. So, they killed the single for 10, 20 years. And now the publishing industry has done the same thing with the mass market paperback. Like, no, people don't like mass market. They really like the trade paperback. It's more durable, it lasts longer, and it's more expensive. So you get the same book, it's bigger, it's heavier, it's harder to cart around, and you pay more for it. Oh, great. And they say, oh, people don't like the mass market. Well, it's just not available most of the time. Unless it's a cheap mystery or romance, you can't even find mass market for a lot of books. So, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird was one of the exceptions, and it's really a shame that they're going in that direction.
The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, AMPAS, of course, they throw these awards every year. They spent part of one day last week apologizing for perpetuating ugly stereotypes about Asians on the Oscars, and the other part of the day celebrating their attempts to embrace diversity. In the former case, it involved saying sorry and promising to do better. In the latter, it included adding Reginald Hudlin, Gregory Nava, and Jennifer U. Nelson to the 51-member-strong Board of Governors.
Also known as the Politburo. 51, my God.
Also, other members were added to various committees, such as Gael Garcia Bernal, joining the Awards and Events Committee, because, you know, having Bernal at any award or event makes it both more diverse and certainly sexier. Big deal or big whoop?
This is a big whoop, obviously. It's just a fairly meaningless, you know, this Board of Governors is so huge that adding three more people, slapping them in there is almost insulting in a way. And they're just adding them on to the ones that are there. I didn't like the way they did it. It was technically not with the rules, so they had to work a way around it. It's a meaningless symbolic gesture. I'm glad these people are there. I'm sure they'll bring a good perspective, but there's a lot of bigger problems than that.
Hamilton isn't the only show on Broadway making history. The musical Wicked has now grossed $1 billion from its Broadway location alone, and it did it in record time. Wicked passed $1 billion in 12 and one half years, faster than The Lion King, which took 16 years, and faster than The Phantom of the Opera, which took 27 years to get there. The fact that the show has been playing for 27 years should have been impressive enough. Those are the only three shows so far to hit $1 billion worldwide from Broadway performances alone. Worldwide, Wicked has grossed almost $4 billion and counting from touring productions crisscrossing the U.S. and the world, as well as merchandise and, you know, and everything else. A movie version remains on the back burner for Universal, surely due in part to the fact that the show remains one of the top five grossing productions on Broadway each year. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a very big deal. I mean, you know, it's only three Broadway shows have done it. Only 24 movies have grossed more than $1 billion, and they've been playing all over the world. So I don't know what the total is when you add in worldwide grosses, but I'm sure it's more than three for Broadway for, you know, musicals. So that's just really a significant thing. You look at Book of Mormon, that is chugging along. That's in a much smaller house, but that'll probably get there someday. It's still hugely popular after 6 years. Wicked is, however, the 10th longest running show in Broadway history. So, you know, it's certainly the exception to the rule. It's not like you make a Broadway show and you're going to make $1 billion. But The Lion King, as we mentioned before, it's the highest grossing single creative thing in history. Like a movie, a book, a TV show, a Broadway musical. It's the highest grossing thing ever. $6.2 billion it's made and counting, because it's still running on Broadway.
A survey by SNL Kagan insists that despite growth in cable subscriptions and solid satellite results, the total number of paid subscribers to cable, satellite, and telco lost more than 1 million combined subscribers in 2015. That's four times the quarter of a million they say were lost in 2014, and the third consecutive year that the total number of subscribers has dropped. The total number of U.S. subscribers to pay TV in one form or another is 96.7 million households. However, they did note that the drop seemed to stabilize in the fourth quarter of 2015. Another survey, this one by Digital TV Research, says 2015 was notable because there were losses in all three major categories, namely cable, satellite, and IPTV. Cable has been losing subscribers since 2011, satellite since 2014, and IPTV joined them in 2015. It anticipates just losing 2 million subscribers over the next 5 years. This is happening all over the world. We just don't have numbers for it. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm just confused. I mean, the other survey is a bit of a counter to the first survey. It says, yes, there were losses in all three categories, but they're slowing. And we think over the next 5 years, you're just going to lose 2 million people, which is a slowdown from what was just been happening. And plus, there's surveys. I'm like, can't we just get actual figures? Why do we have to have surveys and estimates? Why can't we have actual numbers of what's going on in all these areas? More importantly, I want to look at the other end. And I'm sure someone's doing a survey of this. What are people paying in their monthly bills for entertainment? You know, if they are cutting back on their cable or they reduce their cable bill, but they're adding in Netflix and Amazon Prime and Hulu, maybe their total bill is the same or more.
Yeah.
So
but,
it's a net cable bill or a Netflix or Hulu or whatever, I want to know what they're actually paying for entertainment.
Well, you know, it's funny. I got my cable bill earlier this week.
How much is it?
And it's like $165.
That includes what kind of a cable speed, internet speed?
It's like 50-10. So 50 down, 10 up.
Is that good? Are you happy with that?
Yeah,
I mean, obviously
so far,
you want faster.
Yeah, it would be great for it to be faster. But what makes it keep going up from like, it started out at 115. It's now at 165. And just last month, it was 154. So somewhere it went up by about $10.
Is it the taxes or what is it?
No, it's some network that they bundle in to the package that went up and they're passing the expense along to me. It really does make me go, you know what? I think it may be time to start cutting back on cable.
Well, you haven't done it yet. When is your commitment over?
Oh, I'm not under any contract.
Oh, why don't you call them up and threaten and have them renegotiate? I mean, everybody doesn't. They cut off $20 or $30, $40 and that lasts for a year or something. And
you know what? You're right. I'm going to do that right now.
Let us know what happens.
I will. I'll be right back.
You say, hey, my cable bill's gone up 3 months in a row. What's going on? I'm not happy. It's too much. I'm going to quit.
And then they do something about it?
Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
Everybody threatens to go to satellite or say, I'm just going to get Hulu and Netflix and Amazon. I don't need you anymore. I'm like, all right, we'll cut $20 off.
And then I'll stay for another 3 years.
Yes, exactly.
Indiana Jones is back.
Da, 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 da.
Yes, Harrison Ford and Steven Spielberg are grabbing the whip and the fedora and planning one more adventure for Indiana Jones. I don't know why I'm doing it in that voice.
No, I do. It's appropriate.
Of course, it's going to be with the original director and star. Kathleen Kennedy and Frank Marshall will be producing, but George Lucas apparently won't be involved. He is just not invited to any more parties. George Lucas is out.
I'm assuming he chose not to be involved.
Exactly. They haven't set a start date for shooting, don't seem to have a script or even a setting or, you know, a general idea for the movie yet, at least not one they're sharing. But naturally, they have one thing, Michael, and this is really the most important thing you can have when you're starting to make a movie. You need a release date. Indiana Jones will be coming to a theater near you on July 19th, 2019. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. Why not make one more Indiana Jones movie with the original people? That's what they should have done with Tobey Maguire. I don't know why they didn't. But anyway,
they should have made an Indiana Jones movie with Tobey Maguire? What a great idea. Get his agent on the phone.
It's just he's old. You know, you watch Star Wars and frankly, I didn't, you know, they tried to let him be just the young. It's like he should have been more of an acknowledgement. He was an old guy. He's sort of shambling around. He's old. He's in the 70s. You know, you can't make action films. But apparently there's some possibility that's going to be like him handing off the whip like they tried to do last time, or a flashback to a much younger Indy, so that it will be somehow, you know, segue to a new Indy. So that may be the idea here, so that he's not completely running around at like 77 and looking silly. Cause you don't want that. You don't want it to be Indiana Jones and the colonoscopy, you know?
There's the title for our show, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, you should do that. So it's telling that this notice came out the same day as a story saying they narrowed down the search for the next young Han Solo down to a few finalists. You know, it's like, hey, they're not going to stop making Indiana Jones and Han Solo movies just because Harrison Ford is old.
Or that they, well, I shouldn't, spoiler alert, I was going to, you know.
What, do you know who's playing Han Solo?
No, I was going to say what happened in, you know, the...
Oh, yeah.
I think they just need to get J.J. Abrams to reboot Indiana Jones.
Please, no.
Okay, Michael, here's the deal. It's real now, okay? Virtual reality is about to become a mainstream consumer product, and naturally, it's happening first via, and no, I'm not going to say porn, I'm going to say video games. Facebook has Oculus coming out this week for a cost of $600. In April, HTC releases Vive for $800. And Sony last week announced PlayStation VR, which will come out in October for just $400. The first two devices need a high-end PC to work. The PlayStation VR is compatible with PlayStation 4, which already has 36 million consoles in people's homes. You'll also need controllers and a camera for the PlayStation VR, or you can buy a bundle for $499. Big deal or big whoop?
That's $499 on top of the $400?
No. It's like you get the VR, the camera, the controllers.
Oh, so the controllers and the camera was only an extra $100?
Yes.
Oh, so we do know what they cost. Oh, well, that's really cheap.
As a matter of fact, you can't pre-order the PlayStation VR.
But without.
You can pre-order the bundle. So that should kind of tell you what they're really doing.
Who the hell would want it without the bundle? Nobody.
Right. So they got 2 days worth of press for this by saying, oh, it's going to be $399 and a little asterisk.
So this is, it's cheaper than the other two. And if you already have your PlayStation 4, then you're set.
Correct.
So this is real. Sony says they got hundreds of developers working on titles. There will be 50 available by the end of the year. Sky TV announced that they have a virtual reality studio. They've done hundreds of short films already that are virtual reality ready. They've got 20 more, I think, of more substantial sort ready for 2016 that they're working on. They're more elaborate. So virtual reality, it's here. It's coming. Just let me know when you've actually got something in the stores that people can buy and look at and decide on. And that's where we're finally hitting it, isn't it? So it's kind of exciting. Will you buy any of them? I won't.
No, I won't.
No?
No.
You won't? You'll just go check it out and see what it's like.
Yeah, I've already checked out the Vive. And it's interesting. You know, I feel like we're in the period of time when...
early adapters.
Yeah, it's like, you know, nothing really seems to be exciting. The most exciting thing was the Ridley Scott thing that Fox did with The Martian.
Martian, yeah. But these are actual games. You'll be able to, you know... paint with a virtual brush. You'll be able to, they've got some cool video games, some immersive experiences. Some people say, oh no, don't try and mimic reality. It's better to create a whole weird environment because that's easier to make seem real to you because it's not trying to reflect the real world and therefore the rules are different. So I've looked at like some of the games that they showed that are coming out and they look pretty cool.
Well, you know, by Christmas, everybody can be in their homes looking like ding-a-lings with those helmets on. But here's my question. If I can paint like I'm really painting, why not just get a paintbrush, some paint, and some canvas? I can actually paint.
Then write your name and then circle around and look at it from behind.
Yeah. Okay, fine. Mariah Carey is getting real.
Virtually real?
Almost, yes. The music superstar has toured the world, played Vegas, and now she's facing the final frontier, her own reality series. Yes, Carey is doing an 8-episode behind-the-scenes peek at her life for the E! Entertainment Channel. And I love this quote. It's filming now. E! Promises, this quote is great, a unique, vulnerable, and surprisingly humorous side to Mariah that her fans have never before seen while showcasing her unparalleled celebrity lifestyle filled with true glamour, maximum luxury, and ultimate stardom. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. I've never been a particularly big Mariah Carey fan. She certainly has some good singles, and she's been a poisonous influence on singing. But nonetheless, this makes me very sad.
You know, I hate anytime I'm going to some event and they're like, and Mariah Carey will be here. I'm like, oh, man. She always shows up late to everything. Yeah, yeah. I mean, remember in Cannes, we went to the, she was late for that, too. Unbelievable. Yeah. Okay. What was the name of that film? Precious.
Yes, but it's very sad. Very sad. You know, making a reality series is just not a good sign.
The Busan Film Festival takes place in South Korea, but its mayor has been behaving more like it's North Korea. When it screened a documentary in 2014 that the mayor objected to, the festival's budget was slashed dramatically for 2015. Now, just last month, the festival's director was fired. The mayor named himself the head and added 68 new advisors so he'd have a supermajority on any vote because I guess being the head of the festival wasn't enough.
It's even bigger than the AMPAS board of governors or whatever.
Yes, that's
true. We've got more members than the AMPAS.
Top directors in town say they will boycott unless things change before the festival takes place in October. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, you know. It's a international film festival. It draws people from around the world. It's been going on for a couple decades. And they have to speak out. And if they want to maintain the integrity of it, they have to fight back. The only people that matter are the directors and the artists who go. You know, the mayor doesn't matter. The people running the festival don't matter. If you decide you don't like Cannes, nobody will go to Cannes. Cannes falls apart. You know, the talent has all the power. And if they think something is wrong, they need to act because they are the ones who can change it.
You know, it just dawned on me. They arrested the Paris attacker over the weekend in Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if Cannes, you know, would you be nervous going to Cannes this year?
No.
Okay. Would you be nervous if you had to jump into a tank of water with a killer whale?
Yes.
Okay. Well, the amusement park SeaWorld announced it would immediately stop breeding orcas worldwide. So you don't have to worry about it. The killer whales in their parks would be the last ones they would ever have.
Wow.
Activists and the director of the documentary film Blackfish praised the decision, but said it wasn't enough. They also want the whales currently in captivity to be released into the wild. However, one killer whale is pregnant, and SeaWorld insists no human-raised whale or dolphin has ever survived being released. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It's obviously because of Blackfish and protests, and it's a major change for the company. My immediate thought was, well, what's the company going to do? What are they going to do at SeaWorld? And I thought, well, do these killer whales, do they live for like 100 years? Are they punting their decision, you know, as far as say, oh, we'll never have any more. But like if they have a young whale, it'll last for 50, 60 years and they don't have to worry about it. You know, they can say, let someone else deal with this issue when the whale gets old and dies in 2067. So I looked it up. I was like, what is the life expectancy for orcas, for killer whales? It depends. Are you in the wild or are you in captivity? In the wild, you can live up to 50 to 100 years if you're a woman and 30 to 60 years if you're a man. But in captivity, SeaWorld claims that it's more like 30 years for women and 16 for men. But activists and people say actually it's a lot shorter. So you do live a lot fewer years if you're in captivity. People argue about how much, but it is possible that even with a pregnant whale, we're talking about a 20-year time span before there's no whales left for SeaWorld. So, you know, that is a pretty ticking clock, isn't it?
Well, and they've said that they're not going to be doing the shows anymore either, so they're not training them.
Once they're done with the whales that they have, but I thought, well, are they giving themselves like a 60-year window here? In which case, you know, the people making the decision won't have to deal with the after effects, or are they actually stopping it like next week? Well, they've got at least 10 or 20 years to go before they actually stop doing the shows because they still have plenty of whales on hand.
And again, to reiterate, you're not going to swim with any
no.
of them.
Okay. I mean, perhaps I misunderstood. Are you saying they're going to stop the shows today and just keep these whales privately until they die? My understanding was that, well, they've got them there. They're going to do the shows until the whales are gone. But maybe I'm wrong about that.
My understanding was that they were going to stop the shows, but I could be wrong about that myself.
Yeah. Talk to us, SeaWorld.
Would they be doing it in dolphin speak or in whale speak?
Yeah.
Are you annoyed you can't always catch up on the current season of your favorite television show? Well,
yes.
ABC is listening to you, Michael.
Good.
They just signed a new deal with Warner Brothers Television, and among the sticking points were what are called stacking rights.
I had never heard of this. I had to look it up. Did you know that phrase?
Yes, I did, but I always thought it referred to, you know, pancakes, actually.
Yeah. Keep up.
That phrase refers to a network's right to offer the entire current season of a TV show to its viewers via streaming on demand. So all future Warner Brothers shows on ABC will be offered in full on ABC's offerings via their website and an app and so on, instead of just being able to see the five most recent shows, which is common now, you'll be able to binge watch the entire current season. Warner Brothers retains the full rights to the on-demand and syndication markets after the season ends. This is probably something you're going to see repeated not only in North America, but all over the world. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, and I'm not quite sure why Warner Brothers would have had to go through all the rigmarole to make this happen. I would think you would want that. You got a show on a network. You want the current season. You want to be able to people to catch up and watch it. There's not, you know, the syndication rights is years down the road, and I don't think you would exhaust a show's potential by allowing people to catch up on the current season, and plus the extra revenue of, you know, on demand and all that sort of stuff. So
no, it was strictly that, you know, the networks, the affiliates don't want it. The cable companies don't want, the MSOs don't want it, because you're basically training people that, you know what, when it's on television, it's not a big deal whether you miss it or not. You know, it's whether you see it on television, you can always catch it later. So it doesn't really matter.
The current season, though, you can't watch any show ever. I don't get it, because you've got past seasons available on Netflix and Amazon and Hulu. It's the new world we live in. There's just everything's available somewhere somehow now. And why the only thing that shouldn't be available is the current season that you're just trying to watch and catch up on doesn't make any sense. You can get old seasons on DVD. You can watch them on, you know, various outlets. You can buy the whole thing on download. You can watch South Park on a website and go to season 4 and watch episode 13. Why should the only thing you can't watch is the current season when you're just trying to catch up. Again, you're solving a problem that doesn't, you know, you're fighting a problem that doesn't exist. People have DVRs, they have this stuff, they have on demand. Why you would want to say, okay, but you have to catch the five most recent, not the sixth episode. That one you can't do. You're hearing about Scandal and you decide you want to catch up now. Sorry, you're out of luck. You can't watch the whole season. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me.
You know what doesn't make any sense to me? Is that money can't buy you love, but it can buy you the publishing rights to all 250 Beatles songs. Sony just paid $750 million to the estate of Michael Jackson so it could gain total control over their joint venture, Sony ATV Music Publishing. Among the many valued artists who are represented in what is the world's largest music publishing company are Bob Dylan, Leonard Cohen, Taylor Swift, and of course, the crown jewel, the Fab Four. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a huge deal. $750 million. Michael Jackson paid $47.5 million for ATV back in 1985, and it was a top dollar price, and everybody around him told him not to do it. Walter Yetnikoff, I think David Geffen, everybody's like, no, Michael, it's too much money. It's not a good deal. Don't do it. Michael's like, I think the Beatles songs are worth it. You know, so he's now $47 million to $750 million to buy him out. So this whole catalog, by the way, has like 3 million copyrights. So it's a lot bigger than just the Beatles, but obviously they're extremely valuable. So, and by the way, when I was looking up this story and the history of it, I stumbled across a story by Zach O'Malley Greenberg, who's been on our show. He wrote a story for Forbes about how Michael Jackson made that deal happen way back when. It's really good. It's a lot of fun. If you have any interest in Michael Jackson or pop culture or this deal, we have a link in our show notes to that story on Forbes.
Well, for Sony's sake, I hope the Beatles amount to something. And if you want to listen to Zach O'Malley Greenberg on Showbiz Sandbox, you can visit our website at showbizsandbox.com. He was on episode 101 back in 2011, May of 2011. He explained how Jay-Z went from street corner to corner office. It was a fascinating episode, actually. Episode 101.
I mean, you can overpay, obviously, for any creative property. But Michael Jackson's point was like, this is Picasso. These are unique works of art. They're incredibly valuable. They'll only go up. It has to be worth the deal worth making. And I had the same argument with my brother on The Muppets. The Disney bought The Muppets in 2004 for $75 million. They didn't buy everything. They didn't get the Sesame Street characters. But they got the rights to The Muppets, to Bear in the Big House, all the Muppet TV shows and the movies, except a few little distribution quirks. But basically, the whole Muppet library that you think of when you think of the Muppets. So $75 million. Guess what? That one Muppet movie that Jason Segel oversaw, that grossed $165 million worldwide and only cost $45 million. So that alone. But when you think of Disney and the parks and how they can incorporate the Muppets into their parks and capitalize on the merchandising, etc. I thought, like, they can't overpay. My brother's like, you're an idiot. I'm like, they can't overpay for the Muppets. It's crazy. They're the best company in the world to get them. They'll make the most money off of them. And the Muppets are an enduring property. And mind you, that ABC sitcom's not doing very well. But you can catch up on all the episodes if you... No.
Well, you know what? You cannot buy the Beatles music anymore because Sony owns it. But during Inside Baseball...
Rights.
Well, the publishing rights, yes. But during Inside Baseball, we're going to tell you something that you can buy. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, this week, what I was referring to is you can buy another crown jewel, CBS Radio.
Well, now I would consider it a crown jewel, and obviously symbolically it's hugely important for CBS. It's been a part of the company. It's what they built their fortune on. And in a way, this is sort of like the equivalent to Disney's original animation studio. Pixar was firing on all cylinders, but it really meant a lot to Disney to have Frozen click and to now have Disney Animation also delivering huge properties to the company and be a creative and commercial powerhouse. It really means a lot to them. CBS Radio, I think, had that intangible importance to the CBS company. Does it still have it today? Is CBS Radio still a crown jewel? They're saying no, right?
Well, in most earnings, the most recent earnings report, radio revenue had fallen 5% year over year. So they're saying, look, this is something that's going down year over year. Radio is not as sexy as it used to be. Advertisers aren't necessarily flocking to radio. And, you know, as you said, Michael, CBS got its start way back in 1928 when William Paley bought CBS Radio. and kind of turned it into this huge conglomerate of television stations and radio stations all across the country. And there are, I don't even know how many radio stations they have these days. It's the second largest radio chain, 70 million listeners nationwide each week. It's 117 stations in 26 markets.
See, you do know. There's six of them in LA alone. You can't go anywhere without hearing CBS radio.
That is true, yes.
So my question is, and you know, is this a case of like, hey, radio is a dying industry, get out while you can. Cars are going to have all these in-dash things, and they're going to be streaming their iPhones and satellite and all this stuff, and nobody's going to be listening to radio even in their car. Or is it that, no, radio is a fine business. It's just not going to grow by 20 or 30% a year. It's a good business, and Warren Buffett should want to buy it.
I don't know where Warren Buffett came into this whole thing.
Well, because he shows an eye for not needing sexy, hot new things. And there seems to be this trend in investing. Like, if you're not growing by multiples of 20 or 30% a year, nobody wants you. Like, oh, isn't that boring? You're just making money every year. You're a mature industry making money, as if that's somehow a bad thing. To me, that sounds like a stable, great thing. But what do I know? So Warren Buffett would typically be the counterintuitive guy who'd say, I don't know why CBS is selling this. It's a good business. Do I think there's value in radio for decades to come? Yes or no?
I think that there's value. It's going to decline, though. It's going to reach a new low and then kind of a level off. So
you think there's still value in radio. It's obviously not going to be like it was before, but yeah, there's money to be made.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because this was an announcement made by CBS chairman and chief executive Leslie Moonves. What is it, like less than a month after he took over that role?
Yeah.
You know, because Sumner Redstone...
It was probably in the works already.
Yeah, Sumner Redstone is no longer in charge, and Leslie Moonves is, you know, immediately getting rid of the radio group. It's been spun out, but of course CBS is in control of it.
It's like when some of these conglomerates got rid of their publishing and I'm like, or their magazine. I'm like, oh, really? You know, they all think it's just going to collapse and be no good anymore. It's no fun anymore. I'm like, I don't know. I think it's still, I mean, I know it's radio, but I think there's a backlash, or will be, from like the massive access to all music ever made that overwhelms people. And I think they will find a stability and a return to a personality-driven DJs, perhaps, and just the fact that radio is making the choice for you. It's easy. Maybe it's because I spend a lot of time late nights in diners and cafes and Dunkin' Donuts, and I hear radio a lot now more than I have in ages because I love driving, but I usually play my own music.
I've never
been a big radio listener, but I hear Delilah all the time. And it's just, you know, radio is just, it's easy. You hear it in
stores.
You should
point out Delilah is not a person. It's a song.
And no, it's a person, Delilah, the lovelorn advice woman.
Oh, okay.
She's a nationally syndicated figure, I think.
Apparently, I don't listen to radio.
Yeah. No. So, you know, it's just like, I feel like I know they've got a million choices and they could do it, but it's kind of exhausting and actually people kind of like it, you know, oh, let you make the decision. Or also personality driven. So I think there is a future for radio in the sense of, yeah, there's 8 million choices and you can get anything you want anytime, but people don't have the time to make all those choices and they want someone to make them for them sometimes. Driving in a car, sitting in a cafe, radio has a role.
Well, yeah, and I tried to look up, like, how is radio doing in other territories? It's not
interesting.
It's not easy to find out. And of course, in every territory, there are regulations around broadcast radio that, you know, are different.
Right. I mean, the UK radio is a big force, you know, with the BBC radio and the pirate stations and all that. They're a very big creative force, at least. I don't know how they're doing advertising wise.
Yeah. And that's what I was trying to find out. And I was I failed miserably, in fact.
There must be some radio industry figure who looks at worldwide radio's play and how it's doing. So let us know, right? And if they can, how do they reach out to us?
Well, they can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's D-I-R-T at showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find ways to subscribe to us. And we do appreciate it when you subscribe to us in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can usually find our podcasts there. And if you can't, please let us know. Please rate and review the shows there. Subscribe to the shows. iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also again, where you'll find those ways to contact us or follow us. You can follow us on Twitter. At Showbiz Sandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook, where our page can be found. If you search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come right up. Again, that's on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace, if that still exists. I know it was just sold recently, or on their website, who is MGMT.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
I was going to say iHeartCBSRadio.com, but I think that might be contradictory.
Wait, don't they own iHeartRadio?
Do they own it? I wasn't sure.
Oh, no, maybe that's Clear Channel. I don't know.
I think it's Clear Channel, actually. So that doesn't make any sense. So I'll just say thescreeningroomisdead.com.
Okay, well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated, where you can always check out the Huffington Post, or, you know what, you can head to bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.